Welcome to a Cult of Personality podcast. Joining us today is a very special guest. We have with us Taw David Beth, who is the author of the recent publication called Voodon Gnosis. It's an excellent book, and it's available from Scarlet Imprint Press. David is also the Sovereign Grand Master of the OTOA and LCN, and also serves as Gnostic Bishop in Ecclesia Gnostica Aeterna. David, welcome to the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Well, it's good to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And before we get started, I just want to say again, I recently purchased and read your new book, Voodon Gnosis, which I think serves as a fantastic introduction to the subject.
Well, I appreciate your compliments. Thank you very much, really. They were really happy, especially, learned occultists, practicing occultists have these good things to say.
Yeah, and I also wanted to share an observation. I showed the book to a close friend who's engaged in this work as well, and he simply held it and looked at it for just a moment, and he said, it's obvious to me that this work has been created with a tremendous amount of love.
Oh, and thank you.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I appreciate that a lot.
So, without further ado, why don't we get into some questions here?
Absolutely.
Would you please discuss the different esoteric schools and organizations that you lead and their purpose?
Well, yeah, I can do that briefly. I mean, as you said before, I mean, probably I'm best known to be involved with the OTOA and LCN of Hierophant Michael Bertieu. So, probably let's start there. And, probably what most people know is that the OTOA and LCN are previously Haitian-based occult societies or Gnostic occult societies. And why they're actually usually referred to as together OTOA and LCN, they're actually technically separate organizations. Although, they're like sister organizations, you could say. The OTOA basically comes from Haiti. It was practiced there in secret societies, also referred to as Gnostic Voodon. And it's basically a synthesis of ancient Haitian and African sorcery and Gnosticism and European Gnostic Hermetic currents. And the Haitian initiates who founded these groups fused these together in a very thorough way, and this is what the OTOA came to be. While the La Couleuvre Noire, the LCN, is more specialized. It's a much more specialized group that is more focused on the aspect of sorcery, the aspect of direct spiritism. So you could call it a specialized course in Gnostic Voodon, so to say. Mm-hmm. And my role there is, of course, I'm the SGM, the Sovereign Grand Master, and technically I am in charge of the well-being of the groups, you could say. Mm-hmm. And I think most people know quite a lot about these groups. I mean, they have been very influential in lots of ways. Kenneth Grant's books are full of references to OTOA Gnosis and Voodoo Gnosis in general. So let me move on to the other groups, and if you have any specific question in regards to any of them, you can just ask me, and I'll try to go into a bit more detail. Well, the other groups I'm involved in is, as you said, the Ecclesia Gnostica Aeterna. That's a Gnostic church, an apostolic Gnostic church. And it is basically a group that teaches Gnostic development, Gnostic attainment, spiritual liberation, we could say, based on the sacraments. And The sacraments, the way we work them, are empowered by the apostolic tradition, which for us is not necessarily something that is ultimately only tied in to Christianity or anything Orthodox Christianity, but for us it is more of a continuation of the ancient mystery schools. We believe that through especially the Gnostic branch of Christianity and the sacramental system in general, the way of empowerment of the end of antiquity and the ancient mystery schools has been brought to us in the modern times. So this is basically the way we view the importance of an apostolic empowerment of the sacraments. And we believe the sacraments to be tremendous, tremendously powerful tools of, or seeds, or providing seeds of gradual enlightenment, we could say. Mm-hmm. So the Chiesa Gnostica Aeterna basically teaches people to gradually develop as Gnostic beings, as a gradual ascend to enlightenment, we could say, in a simplistic way. And the gnosis of this group is rather specific. It is not so much, it's not so much like the ancient Gnostics, who are rather escapists, who believe this world to be a horrible, bad place, and who didn't want, you know, nothing more than to escape from it and, you know, leave the body behind and make a quick escape and a quick exit. The gnosis that we teach in our Gnostic Church is something we call cosmic gnosis, and we believe actually that it is through the body and through the experience of the senses that we can achieve a kind of gradual enlightened state, in which we achieve a kind of, you could say, a unified experience with the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Something that does not push us away from existence, or that does not create the type of dualism that we are used to from Christianity, ancient Gnosticism, or most other religions or spiritual systems, actually. I think we'll get to this, to these kinds of things later on anyway, so let me move on to the next group, which is the Fraternitas Borealis, which is, you could call it probably a Hyperborean kind of a magical group. It is also working in this kind of cosmic tradition, but is more focused to, let's say, magical explorations. While the Gnostic Church is more about, you could say, a general transformation towards spiritual and personal liberation, the Fraternitas Borealis tries to achieve the same thing, but places much more emphasis on experimenting, on magical techniques, and on, you could say, sorcery, probably. Mm-hmm. And, and I think this, again, will be of a topic later on. So why don't you just ask me anything specific you want to know, and then we can go more deeper if there's anything about these groups you want to know.
Okay. I think first off, I just wanted to comment and say I very much appreciated the sort of explanation in terms of the Gnostic Church and differentiating it in terms of the modern sort of gnosis as opposed to what people have historically thought of Gnostic philosophy. Because I think that seems to be a point that is not often understood by a wider audience.
Absolutely.
I think one of the questions I had, if you wouldn't mind, and I know this is probably not a very brief answer, but I'm just curious if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the history of the OTOA current and LCN current, and sort of how a more fraternal Masonic type of organization sort of transmuted into a more magical, ecclesiastical, spiritually empowering type of system.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely. I can give you some ideas on that. Basically, the OTUA never was, as far as my own experience and, speaking with Virtue and all these things, the OTUA never really was, a big Masonic fraternal organization, really. Mm-hmm. I think it always was, it was maybe more so back in the days than it is now, but even then it was a rather, selective type of people, a specially selected group of people who practice a very specific type of esoteric Wudang, which was a more abstract, in some parts more abstract type of Wudang, but at the same time very practical. But I think where we could say it was more Masonic was maybe the setting, the way people came together in an OTOA context back in the days was more a Masonic lodge type. But basically, what was maybe a bit more Masonic were the influences that they had as well. So, for example, there is the influence of Memphis Mizraim. There is the influence of the Royce OTO. There are Martinist influences, which of course were all more Masonic type of organizations. So I think while some of the adepts of OTOA had these kind of transmissions or were also part of these other groups, they actually took these inspirations or they took actually the empowerments of these groups and kind of stripped away the Masonic Überbau, you could say, mm-hmm. and tried to distill the magical and esoteric empowermental qualities from these groups in some kind of, you could call it an alchemical process maybe, and fuse it with what they originally worked as OTOA, which was basically a specific form of esoteric Wudang. And this is how those esoteric Western Hermeticism and all these things came into the OTOA. And then gradually, the more things moved ahead in the 20th century, the less it became Masonic. More and more those Masonic elements, even that were still there, kind of were moved out, and it actually turned into a very, very, very small group of people in Chicago at one point, and a couple of people in New York and Haiti, who actually worked in a very, very, very intimate setting. I don't know, they may not have been more than maybe 50 people involved in OTOA and LCN in probably the 60s. So it became a very, very personal kind of working group. You could call it a magical lodge dedicated to a very specific type and very a certain type of work, which really had little to do with Masonry, although sometimes Masonic symbolism or Masonic ritualistics were even employed if it was thought necessary to transmit empowerments or initiations. Mm-hmm. Because I believe it's important, and I think Bert, you think so as well, and other people, I think it's very important that initiations and empowerments are being given in a context in which they work. For example, you're a Gnostic bishop, you know this well. An ordination or a sacrament must be given in a certain form if it's being empowered by the apostolic succession, because only in this kind of form it will have any kind of esoteric effect, because they were conceived in a type of system or in a kind of symbolism. And only if you retain this kind of symbolism, at least at the core, in my opinion, things actually will work properly.
Right.
So basically what they tried to do is strip away as much of the brimborium, the big robes and the big movements and you know, the theatrics, you could say. They try to strip them away, but at the same time retaining a very deep, fundamental, esoteric knowledge of symbolism and of the roots. It's not chaos magic or you know, chaos magic in the profane sense or some kind of eclecticism where, you know, you just grab whatever, you know, you find interesting and just mix it together with without any deeper understanding of where it comes from or without any deeper initiation into the systems that you actually take things from. Mm-hmm. So basically, you said that quite correctly. In the end, what happened was that the OTO and LCN turned into groups which are extremely empowermental, which have very little group rituals, for example. Usually, things are being done on an individual basis. We don't work in a large context. And if there are initiations and empowerments, and there are actually some, then they are given by a master to a student, you could say.
Okay.
And what is maybe important and interesting for some people to know is that, of course, the LCN and the OTO are not the same. The OTOA, as we said before, if you study the OTOA system, it provides you with a fundamental, basic knowledge of what Gnostic Vudan is all about. And it provides you with a basis you will need if you want to study, let's say, the LCN. Because the LCN is a more specialized course. Back in the days, people would say, oh, the LCN is something like the 17th degree of the OTOA. Of course, this is not true, but it gives a sense, it gives an idea of how it could be worked, you know, that you need the foundations of OTOA first. For example, the 4-year courses of the OTOA, these are the basic teaching tools. And once you have a fundamental grip on the principles, not even on the details, but on the principles taught in these courses, for example, you would be probably eligible to move on to higher LCN studies, for example. Mm-hmm. And you could make even a judgment and see whether that's something you want to actually pursue. Because not everybody may fancy LCN work because of its specific character.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Well, thank you. Yeah, that definitely answers the question. Appreciate that very much. Because the history is not always easily understood. I think it differs in character from a lot of esoteric groups.
Yeah, that's for sure. Mm. I mean, I find it very funny actually when I sometimes look at the history page, you know, even of our own group, and I see, you know, all these mentionings of names of groups of, you know, there was this and there was that, and he was a member here, and then there was this transmission from that. I think it's only for the specialist this kind of stuff is interesting. Same as when Gnostic churches list all the, you know, plenty of lineages they have. You know, I think nobody really is interested in that except for the fact that there is an apostolic lineage, for example. But I think for the specialist it may be interesting to see all those different streams, you know, that came in, and to actually see that the people who impersonated these streams were actually deeply initiated into them. Mm-hmm. And I think back in the days, at least this is my romantic idea of it, at least 100 years ago, I think people were actually working these systems rather than just, you know, acquiring the titles.
Yes, I would like to think the same.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that, you know, many of the ones that, you know, that make up that history actually were. At least the, you know, the ones that we're aware of, I would think. Right. Your recent book, as we mentioned, called Vudan Gnosis, is, I think, best described as an introduction to the system that's laid out in the Vudan Gnostic Workbook by Tal Michael Berdiaw. Could you please tell us, for those who are unfamiliar, again, sort of the different currents and philosophies that compose this esoteric doctrine? And as a follow-up, why do you believe that an introductory work like yours is useful in approaching the tome and the work?
You mean the esoteric doctrine of the Vudan Gnostic Workbook or the LCN?
Basically, the conglomeration that goes to making that up. I think you mentioned a lot of it already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's no problem. I can do that easily. Well, basically, if we focus on the Voodoo Gnostic workbook in regards to your question now, this, of course, is the main public teaching tool of LCN. So if we look at it, it's basically, what it basically is basically a spiritist type of sorcery. The main important point of working with this kind of LCN current, or especially the Voodoo Gnostic workbook, is the establishing of a contact with spirits. And it starts off in the Lucky Hoodoo section of the book. I think it's the first 16 chapters. And it's a very simplistic but powerful way of establishing contact with what Bertieu calls the spirits, the different types, more simple type of spirits than the later spirits that are introduced, which are Livudu or the Deloas. They're more higher evolved type of spirits. But the basic point is that all this work is basically done through a very symbiotic and close relationship of practitioner and spirits. And of course, we're not very dogmatic. We're not dogmatic to say what exactly the spirits are. Are the spirits external beings, or are the spirits, you know, more Jungian archetypes, or some kind of unconscious sparks, or whatever it is? I don't think it's actually very important to make that distinction, as long as you can have a precise way of dealing with these things. And the Voodoo Gnostic workbook is very complex, and of course very, very confusing to lots of people, because it introduces all types of things, Shintoism, Iowa's physics and whatnot, and all kinds of things. But basically, what one needs to keep in mind is that the foundation of LCN work and of the Voodoo Gnostic workbook is something that is called esoteric voodoo, which is the indigenous esoteric doctrine of Gnostic Voodoo and of all of the LCN and OTOA work. And this is a very deep kind of system of sorcery and even Gnostic thought in itself. And if you have a fundamental grip and grasp on these kinds of things, it is very easy for somebody who's advanced at this to incorporate other, let's say, details or other things from other systems. If you have a fundamental understanding of how metaphysics work, to incorporate them into your own system, which was done, of course, in Haiti in Orthodox Voodoo or exoteric Voodoo all the time. Same can be done, of course, in esoteric Voodoo. So, you know, Bertieu spent time in Japan, and he had some initiators there who introduced him to some kind of esoteric Shinto cults and other things. And by his deep fundamental knowledge of spiritual systems and of his own spiritual background plus esoteric Voodoo, he was able to kind of draw parallels and incorporate important things that he found valuable for teaching in his own groups into those groups. And things that actually make a lot of sense if you kind of follow them up. So it's not a kind of simplistic, taking a bit of here and taking a bit of there, like kitchen magic, you know. You take a little ingredient here and a little ingredient there, you know. Mm-hmm. More or less the simplistic things which you understand because you don't have time and a sense to go deeper, you know, and cook it together and make up your own type of system. It's not like that. And I think everybody who studies Voodoo Gnosis in a more thorough way will actually come to this conclusion. And I hope that my book actually makes this clear, that it's not some kind of weird cookbook, you know, that the Voodoo Gnostic book is not some kind of weird, they sometimes refer to it as the phone book. I like that, actually. It's not kind of a weird cookbook, you know, of just some ingredients thrown together and which sound cool and which sound crazy and which inspire, you know, people to have a kind of, postmodern short circuit in their brain. But it's actually a very fundamental system of Gnostic attainment and of sorcery, which is very sound and has a very, very deep fundament.
Yes, absolutely.
And well, and as you refer to my book as an introduction, well, yeah, some people say, and a lot of people would say probably it's an introduction, and I think it was also brought out as that, but while I do believe it introduces some areas, I think a pure introduction would have to be much more simplistic. I don't think, for example, a person, let's say a person who has just started esotericism or started occultism, you know, and he's looking around for things, if he would find my book and read it, I don't think he would understand a lot, you know. I think he would be kind of like, you know, thrown aback a bit. But I think for somebody who has already a kind of a fundamental knowledge of esoteric things as such, even maybe not of a Gnostic Voodoo, I think a person like this would find this very, very interesting indeed. Mm-hmm. And so I do believe it highlights areas in the Voodoo Gnostic workbook that may have been a bit obscure, or that have been, or where people, I tried to actually introduce topics where people thought they were nearly there, but still didn't really get it, you know? Where people would tell me, well, I do understand where he's hinting or where he's going, but there's information missing. There's just like, you know, a little bridge missing for me to really make, wrap it up properly. So I actually try to, give people a little idea of how I personally approach it. I don't see my book, for example, as a dogmatic, you know, introduction to how people need to study Voodoo Gnosis or LCN or anything like that. But I try to give them a suggestion of how you could interpret and analyze things and make sense of them. You know, while at the same time, of course, I try to introduce some points which are, of course, official, let's call it doctrine, you know, mm-hmm. although I hate the word.
Yeah, I think that's actually a perfect explanation of the book. That was my impression of it exactly. It certainly made those connections in my own mind about things that I thought I understood but wasn't quite certain about. And yeah. It definitely gives you ways to different perspectives and things to look at this. And it's very, very useful.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to achieve with this book. You know, I mean, I know exactly how I started off in this whole work. I mean, I really had, you know, when I first started to look at the 4-year courses and the Voodoo Gnostic workbook, I was so excited. You know, I read Kenneth Grant's books and I thought it's awesome, it's wild stuff, it's something that's deep, and you know, I had all these kind of fantasies about it. And when I started reading the first, you know. When the first time I glimpsed into the Voodoo Gnostic workbook and then the course, I was like, what the hell, you know, I was like, my God, you know, I can make no sense of this, this is complete, I wasted all my money on that, you know, and I have no idea what he's talking about. And it took me a lot of focus and actually, dedicated work, even in the hard moments where I thought, you know, this is leading nowhere, to come to the point where suddenly things fell into place. You know, and maybe I was more more fortunate than some people because of my many years that I lived in Africa and where I was exposed to, all kinds of currents, which again I found in the Voodoo Gnosis. So at one point, you know, when I didn't stop pursuing it or when I didn't stop researching it, suddenly, you know, the doors opened. Suddenly, the hidden doors, you know, in the whole continuum started to open up, and suddenly things began to make sense. And I just saw it as my duty, also as the SGM of the orders, to finally, you know, maybe, you know, give an example of how somebody who actually studies this stuff, other than Michael Bertieu, who's of course, you know, the source of these things, you know. Approaches that and actually show that it's workable, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was actually my objective here, really.
Yeah, I think you certainly achieved it. It really is a crucial book for anyone who is engaged in this, I think.
Thank you very much.
So for those who are unfamiliar, would you please talk a bit about the Merciless Path and what it is, why it's useful, and as a follow-up, have you encountered any negative reactions from people to the concept or accepting the importance or effectiveness of it?
Yeah. Well, the Merciless Path is quite an interesting... You took that term out of my book, yeah?
I did.
And yeah, and actually, you know, let me take a little reroute here. one of the reasons why I think this book turned out quite okay in regards to explaining concept was because I was fortunate enough to be introduced to this, what I, for simplistic reasons, call this cosmic current, which actually, you know, explained concepts which I had studied previously in voodoo gnosis and which suddenly highlighted things even for me. So I could make connections where previously the connections were much harder to make. And so it enlightened me, or it illuminated a lot of points which were, for me at this point, of course, rather clear, but which back in the days were very hard to wrap my head around. So the Merciless Path, actually, is a term that is taken from the body of the Fraternitas Borealis, basically. And the Fraternitas Borealis is a group which originated in Germany, and it actually works in a type of Saturnian context, you could say. Mm-hmm. The Merciless Path is a path for people, and it's rather specific, I think, for the Fraternitas Borealis, although I think the Merciless Path, the way I will define it in a couple of seconds, hopefully, properly, should be the focus of everybody who studies voodoo gnosis in an initiated sense, or basically any kind of deeper occult system. because what I basically mean with the Merciless Path is somebody who focuses and dedicates his whole being totally to his esoteric, spiritual, and occult calling. And I think the crucial thing about this here is a type of vocation. You need to feel a vocation to be able to really dedicate yourself to this. You know, we live in a world where a lot of people have a lot of time. You know, like even if you work hard, you still have a lot of hours a week where you actually have to fill your the free time. So occultism has become, of course, pop culture. You know, we see it all around. You know, Crowley has become a pop culture icon. You know, occultism and magic is everywhere. There's very little occult about occultism these days. Mm-hmm. So. And a lot of people, you know, who call themselves magicians or who call themselves occultists or so, are of course not really occultists or magicians. You know, they just do this on their spare time, a little bit here, a little bit there, you know, but it is not the type of people, you know, that feel like 100 years ago or you know, what you, even a Catholic priest, they don't feel this vocation to really submit everything else to this kind of path. And the Merciless Path for me is the person who walks this Merciless Path is a person who you could probably call him the sadhu, you know, of Western esotericism. You know, a person who really sacrifices everything in his life in order to follow this vocation. And this vocation must, of course, be a vocation towards spiritual attainment and occultism. And what is so merciless about it is of course that he is required, and his honor and his dedication must always be, of course, to be self-critical about where he's at, about his status quo. It's a constant challenging of his status quo, of his of where he's at, what his motivations are, his ideals. And is a constant challenging of oneself. Is never this kind of easygoing, you know, I'll do a bit of this, I'll do a bit of that, you know, and, is a kind of cruel look in the mirror every day. And, this is something I think very few people actually do. Mm. And this is something that the Fraternita Saturni has emphasized, you know, when they spoke, about Thelema and stuff like that, when they added this, when they added this dictum to love is the law, love under will, when they added compassionless love, is that a correct English term? Yes. Or love without compassion.
Yes.
And you see, you have a lot of I think if you are dedicated to a more extreme version of occultism, which even Kenneth Grant or Crowley or these kinds of people, you know, these people were radicals. These people were occult radicals who had their life focused on a certain thing, which is of course spiritual enlightenment, but of course also occult explorations. They have, and they were ready to really walk the thorny path, and this is basically what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. You know, people who do not, who need to constantly move out of their comfort zone. You know, occultism today is about staying in a comfort zone, doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then, you know, and even the occult path is tailored according to your, you know, current moods, current state of minds, instead of walking a path where, you know, even when it gets hard, you actually keep on walking. The other day I was at a conference and there was a kind of interesting discussion that ensued. There was a woman who said, I was a Thelemite before, but I didn't find a proper way of, attending the large meetings and the group sessions because of my children. So I skipped Thelema, I'm choosing another thing where they are more child friendly, like for example Wicca or something. You know, so that's there we have a circle of people. I can incorporate it better in my family, and now I'm a Wiccan. You know, so people go to the occult supermarket, and buy the ingredients they need, and then they build their own individual religion, and that's fair enough, I believe. For people who want nothing else but maybe a substitution for Christianity, something they can believe in, something where they can do a bit of ritual and have, you know, a feeling of I'm doing something for myself. That's fair enough, you know, like Madonna is a Kabbalist and Richard Gere is a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. But I think if we talk about occultism in the way it was probably conceived back in the days, sorcery and, Gnosticism, I think this is only for people. In the true sense of the word, this is for people who feel a vocation. You know, like the Buddhist monk, like the Catholic priest, you know, like the sadhu who strips off its clothes, you know, is these people who feel this irresistible vocation, this irresistible calling to something, and who are ready to move out of the confinements, who move out of, or who can stand the pressure of society, who will do what it takes to follow this vocation. And this sometimes is, of course, facing a lot of fears. I mean, we live in a society where spiritual things or spiritualism in general is not very highly regarded. You know, I mean, especially in Europe. Europe is extremely secular, and America has a lot of spirituality, but it's, you know this well, this very superficial spirituality of, you know, the evangelists and so forth and so forth.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I think we will talk later a little bit about in what times we live, you know. And I think the state of occultism today is a great reflection of the times we live in, you know. And so when I speak about the merciless path, I want to make sure that people understand that my path or the path of the initiates that I work with is a path of vocation, a path of dedication. That it is not for people who want to have a kind of glimpse in what it means to be esoteric or what it means to be spiritual, you know, or who just do this as a hobby or their spare time. For me, this is a way of life. I couldn't stop doing it. This is the point, basically. Just as a little add-on, I mean, this is the reason, for example, why the OTUA and LCN basically are very selective organizations. We have only a small capacity, for members. We don't have a large membership, not because we couldn't get a lot of people. We get applications all the time, but it's the structure and the idea behind what is an occult group and how it operates, especially if you view an occult order as a magical machine which needs to run very precisely, and especially if it's also based on student-teacher or mentor, we could say, mentor relationships, we need to be able to provide the best possible working environment for the members. But also the members must display the character and the ideals that we need to accommodate them. You know, as we have so few members, or as we want only a few members, these few members have to be people who really work individually, who have a very high degree of experimental facilities and possibilities, you know, who are ready to put in a lot of their own work. And the same goes, of course, for the Fraternitas Borealis, maybe even in a more so sense. You know, it's for people who prefer the Saturnian type of work. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Like we could never provide a kind of social environment or social club feeling like let's say the Caliphate OTO or something. I think they serve a great role and they serve a great purpose. You know, for people you know, who want to live a Thelemic lifestyle and share this you know, with other people. You know, I think Thelema is basically also a kind of a sociological type of, you know, way of being. So, you know, it serves this perfectly. And I think even, you know, the initiations and everything has all its place. But to me, this is not really what I call, or what I would personally see as occult, you know, as proper occult working. It's different purposes, you know, it's different purposes and different different foci.
Yes, that's an excellent perspective, and thank you for that. Let's see. Would you mind talking about, for the people who are interested in learning more and becoming involved in this type of work, what type of advice would you give them?
Well, the most important is these people really need to ask themselves what they want. What they want from occultism, from spirituality, from Gnosticism? You know, what is it that they want? You know, is it to have a lot of materialistic powers? You know, is it to overcome, I don't know, the outsider position? You know, I mean, people must check themselves very realistically, because once they're in a group, I think they will be found out very quickly. I think their motivations will become very clear. And I think especially in smaller groups where you have a much more direct interaction and a much more selective way of handling people, I think, you know, and especially if there's no place for people who just want to hang around and have a good time and, you know, flaunt mysterious names around, people like this will be found out very quickly. So I believe people must check their motivations. Are they really ready to, do they really want to study occultism or Gnosticism because this is what they feel as a vocation? Is this what they feel is their way of life? Or is it something they want to use to supplement, you know, their everyday existence, you know? Like, you know, some people use yoga, you know, for relaxation or you know. Or some people use magic, you know, to kind of like, you know, instead of watching a horror movie, you know, they do magical rituals and impress their girlfriends pretty well. So, you know, you see today, if you make a sociological studies, which I actually did while I was in university, if you make a sociological study of the people who enter occultism today, is usually people who have who are outsiders. You know, people who actually didn't achieve in society. You know, a lot of people are on welfare. A lot of people have no jobs. A lot of people who have been, you know, teased in school, had problematic childhoods, problematic adolescence. You know, and mostly it's people who didn't fit in. You know, who didn't fit in society, not because they didn't want to fit in, but basically because they were not allowed. You know. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who are bullied around and so on and so forth. You know, so a lot of people, of course, you know, end up in occultism as a kind of, you know, place where they can achieve something, you know, where it's an easy way to flaunt around titles, you know, where they are suddenly feel, you know, something of an elitism which they could never achieve in the society outside, you know. They flaunt around, you know, themselves as big, you know, grand commanders and knights of this or of that. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, call other people in the real society, you know, adherents of the slave god while they are free, and so on and so forth. And it's a kind of childish reaction, you know, against the people who have been kicking their ass constantly, you know. Mm-hmm. And we used to make this joke when we were while I was still living in Germany, you know, we used to know these occultists, you know, who would sit in their kind of cellar apartment, you know, with no money, with no electricity, you know, but they were highly initiated, at least in their own minds, and they were always talking about, oh, you know, those slaves outside, you know, those people, you know, they have nothing to live for and this and that, you know. While the people outside were quite happily sitting in a cafe having a good time, well, those people, you know, were kind of bitter, you know, bitter guys sitting in a very cold, you know, broken down environment, had no money and had to, wait for the welfare handout, you know, to give them some kind of food and on their table, you know. And if those people outside would decide to really go into this Darwinism that they always, you know, display in their writings or in their conversations, you know, they would probably look pretty bad. So I think people must really check themselves. What is their motivation? You know, I don't go as far as Rigardi, who says everybody should have psychotherapy, you know, or a psychoanalysis before they or during, you know, their occult work. But I think that actually would help a lot of people to determine why they do this. Why am I here? You know? Why am I applying for this? Why am I applying for membership here? Why am I reading those books? Is it you know, for what's my motivation?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that for me is the most important step. And then of course one must see what type of personality am I? Am I the person who wants to go through a more devotional a path? You know, like maybe a Golden Dawn type of path. Or do I want to have a more extreme approach, you know, like more a sadhu type approach, you know, like maybe in the OTUA or other groups, you know, will provide a more radical approach, a more, you know, it's so inflatious, this word, but left-hand path approach, you know, whatever that means, a more Luciferian approach maybe. But see, these terms have all been, you know, profanized so badly, so probably people will misunderstand that as well. But I think people must check why they're here, and of course they must check which is the way for them to go. Are they ready to, you know, cross over a lot of borders? Are they ready to constantly challenge their likes and dislikes and status quo? And while it sounds pretty easy and it sounds pretty exciting, sometimes this can be extremely hard, and you know, you probably know this very well. So yeah, so people need to really check themselves and see what their motivations are. And people who want to study with me or in my groups basically need to be people who feel a vocation, you know, who feel a calling. And they need to display to me that they actually have had that. And they must, this is why in the past in the OTUA, there was a time in the 80s where they did not accept people under 30. Just basically because they wanted to see that these people have a track record. You know, they wanted to see these people have a track record of spiritual work. They wanted to see whether these people have been working for 10 years on spiritual issues. And, you know, it's not like a 15-year-old who wants to play guitar today and, you know, a year later he wants to be a drummer. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think this is the main key. People need to show that this is what they really want and why.
Yeah. Those are all excellent points. Absolutely, thank you. And sort of the other side of the coin here, if you would please talk a bit about why it is that this work is not for everybody, and it's focusing on some of potential dangers for those who aren't ready, who think they are.
Yeah. Well, I believe this path is... I think this path is has been described by a lot of people, by Kenneth Grant, by Bertieu, even in my book, and all these books about left-hand path, Hinduism, and so on. You know, I think this gives a rather good glimpse of why this path is not for everybody. I think it is not if you talk about spiritual groups or the spiritual scene in general, you know, I think there are a lot of groups, you know, which provide, let's say, a sociological setting or even a spiritual setting for people who just want to have a kind of a bit of a devotional relationship with the divine, you know, do a little ritual here and meet some like-minded people, you know, like lots of spiritual groups in England are like that. And more the fluffy type, without being negative now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very well. I think they need their place. They have their points, and they have their dedicated priesthood, and they have a lot of lay members, which is very well, and which has their place. But the people who enter our type of work, the more what we could consider left-hand path work, is basically people who need to challenge their own ideas, their own ideals, and their own status quo constantly. They may need to do things which they consider inappropriate. Not that we tell them this is what you need to do, you know, but it's the nature of the path. Especially also because in our case we deal with sexual magic logically. So that's, of course, I forgot to mention that, but. This, of course, needs to be a preliminary. You need to want to work with sexual energies, with sexual magic, you know, in all its different ways, and you need to employ it as well, you know, for your spiritual advancement. And some of these things can seem rather extreme, but at the same time, for example, if you are a person who has extreme sexual cravings, let's say, you know, let's say you're a natural born masochist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe then the more extreme thing to be would be to act, in some environments or in some ways as a sadist. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Just because that would probably, you know, help you break through a confinement or a frame. So basically what this path is all about is, it's about breaking through frames, breaking through the status quo constantly, but at the same time employing the senses of the body and or using the body as a temple, as a tool. The body for us is an expression of divine, and through the experience of the body, we can experience the divine. So you must be ready to use the body as in this capacity. And not as the ancient Gnostics did, you know, who just used the body as a tool, or even Crowley, sometimes, I hope I'm correct now, who kind of sometimes said that his body is just a tool, you know, and that's why he can mistreat it, or he can just use it as he sees fit. I don't think so, personally. I believe the body is a holy temple, and it's an expression of the divine, and through the proper employing of the abilities of the body plus the mind and whatever else, you can achieve a type of spiritual enlightenment the way we want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sounds rather interesting to probably a lot of people. It's like, yeah, well, that's cool, you know, we will break frames, and that's kind of, you know, it's probably especially alluring to younger men, probably, although actually we have at least 50% women in our groups. But these men very quickly find out it's not about that. It's not about, you know, satisfying their appetites or satisfying their cravings for you know, a dark magic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a constant challenging of what you think is proper for you, and what you think you like, or what you think you want to do. And it's very interesting to find out how much people, or to see actually how much people change, how much I have changed, for example, from when I was 21 to who I am now. You know, I'm probably a very different person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would have not been a different person if I would have chosen a path where the way I was was kind of supported, you know, which is very easy, you know, it's very easy today to, you know, to choose a path where you just, you know, where you kind of interpret things the way you want to hear them, you know. And this is why, for example, in our path is important that we have a mentor as well who kind of acts as your mirror, you know, who kind of, you know, checks in with you, you know, and bounces back ideas. So you do not get stuck in your own fantasies, and you do not get stuck in your own prejudices and fancies and wishes. And when you ask me for how could it be dangerous, for example, in my book, for example, I gave this example of the notion of esoteric love, for example, which is it's a very simple way of explaining this. I mean, you know, if you work with sexual energies or even the notion of esoteric love, like Sufis and, you know, certain tantric cults and so forth, mm-hmm. you know, it's, you also work, of course, with creating an adrenergic state in your own person. You want to achieve a kind of a liberation and spiritual resurrection within your own self, without actually being dependent on another person or something outside of you. You know, this is probably a Luciferian idea, but to do this, we employ the idea of love, or of esoteric love, which is a great, and of course eros, which are all kind of related, and which creates a great energetic potential. And, you know, the Sufis and other people, and, you know, tantric cultists and so on, and alchemists, they had this vision of a Sora Mystica, or of an esoteric bride, who is, let's say, the opposite polarity for them to kind of incite a type of energy. And it's very easy, you know, to kind of mistake a human being, whether it's a man or a woman, for this kind of, you know, a manifested esoteric bride who takes a role or takes on a life outside of yourself. And a lot of people get lost in that concept. And then if that woman leaves them, they are completely crushed down, they're in despair. They do not understand that the notion of esoteric love is actually to acknowledge and recognize the divine, let's say, opposite, in another person, in the outside person. But basically, it's an inside ideal. Yes, and it's important for me to, of course, say that this does not you know, reduce the ability of romantic relationships and all these kinds of things. I mean, but we must avoid to project, let's say, our profane ways, and profane, I don't mean negative, but our everyday profane ideas on esotericism or on magic or on occultism. You know, the notion of a romantic love with another person is very important, and it's great, but it is not the same as esoteric love as used as a tool and as a necessity to achieve certain kinds of esoteric, you know, stages of enlightenment or whatever you want to call it.
See, David, would you please talk a bit about how some familiar archetypal legends and myths like the Grail Quest are analogous to the great work that you and fellow initiates are undertaking?
I think that's actually a very interesting concept. I mean, the concept of using myth or legends, you know, as let's say as role models, let's you could say, or as guidelines for esoteric quests. For example, you mentioned the Grail Quest. For me, myth, in general, is actually a reality in itself. A myth always transports a kind of, especially, an esoteric reality. I mean, the myths of different tribes, of different people, of different, cultural groups, always, of course, are something of a collective identity or collective memory, especially pertaining to the spiritual world. Which they have clad in myth, or which they have clad in stories, because there was no writings, or there were no other ways of containing these things. And I think myth is especially important, of course, for the people in or for the group of people in which these myths have originated. Because outside this group of people who can align to the symbolism of the myth, and the symbolism is of course always very close to the cultural group, the myth will lose sense. So I think, for example, for the Western world, the myth of the Grail Quest, for example, is a very powerful metaphor for a spiritual quest. Is of course not only a nice adventure story, but logically for me as an occultist, if you have certain tools to unlock these myths, they can actually provide you with a lot of esoteric secrets and a lot of esoteric enlightening tools. So I believe, for example, we in our group, we see Parsifal, for example. In the Hyperborean group, in the Fraternus Borealis, for example, we see Parsifal in the Grail Quest as archetypal seeker of the mysteries, you know, and we see him as a certain type of seeker, more the warrior monk, the type of who walks the merciless path, as you said, a person who sacrifices all for his cause and who employs, you know, what we consider important in our current as well, who employs love, who employs a type of furor, who employs certain tools to achieve his ultimate goal. And by analyzing these myths and applying a certain type of tool to actually take this myth apart and, look at the different sections of it, provides you with clues on how the ancients or the people, a thousand years ago have worked these kinds of currents. And it provides us with a link to, in my opinion, a living occult and living magical tradition. For example, a very easy analogy here in regards to myth, which you of course know very well too, is the Christ myth. The Christ myth, to me as a Gnostic, and probably to you too, is a very important thing, because Christ or Jesus in this is not. I don't really care whether there was actually a person called Jesus who did exactly what they say he did or he did not. Of course, scholars know he did not do these things as they say it in the Bible. But what is important for me is the icon of Christ as a dying and resurrecting God, a person who was a human being, a Jesus, a regular type of guy, but who then through esoteric and spiritual work has attained a kind of godly status, you know, who went on the cross, who died and resurrected, and only when he died, his his profane humanity was transformed into, of course, his godly state as Christ. And in my opinion, these are the things we need to look for. We need to look for what do these myths tell us. I mean, the icon of Christ for me is one of the most beautiful types of metaphors for what the initiate needs to go through. He needs to die to his profane self, crucify himself on the cross of the elements, and resurrect in the higher sense. This is the same as in probably the cults of Mithras and the mystery cultuses that we had in the antiquity, and is the same as if an initiate undergoes the passions of Odin or Wotan, you know. There are rituals in our group, for example, where you would assume the form of Odin and where you would undergo the same kind of trial he underwent when he was on the crucified, or when he crucified himself on the tree and, received the power of the runes and so forth and so forth. To me, these ideas, these legends or these myths, these are all designed to tell us esoteric, or to provide us esoteric knowledge. And if you employ them properly, they can tell us how we as initiates could try to achieve this kind of thing. You know?
Yes.
And I believe especially a myth like the Grail Quest, which of course is so full of symbolism, and songs of the troubadours and all these kinds of things are all veiled with esoteric meaning and esoteric symbolism. And if we properly investigate this in a deep sense and with deep roots, then we can extract a lot of esoteric knowledge from that, which we can use for our own occult work.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I absolutely feel the same way. And it's been my experience, too.
Yes. We will talk more in private about our Gnostic experience. I'm looking forward to that, that's for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Old bishops with a pipe.
Yes. Let's see, would you please expound a bit upon the relationship between the roles of mage and priest or bishop and the practical usefulness of combining these disciplines, if you will, and sort of the maybe a bit about your personal experience in this regard and how it's manifested in your own work?
Well, yeah. Well, this, of course, is only my absolute personal idea and impression, because, you know, one of the things I really want to stress the most is my ideal of teaching occultism or of mentoring or of even the groups I work in is very undogmatic. I try to be as undogmatic as possible. Of course, my idea on the role of mage and bishop is my personal experience. People can totally see it differently whether they study with me or not. But in my opinion, or for me personally, being a Gnostic bishop or having undergone Gnostic ordinations and sacraments provide me with, let's say, my overall spiritual transformation. That it provides me with my general transformation from, let's say, gross profane human to whatever I consider in my personal way my Luciferian enlightenment, we could say, or my spiritual enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. And I believe my Gnostic ordinations and my Gnostic sacraments have been absolute. I think without these things, I would not be the person I am today, and I would not feel the same degree of freedom, in a spiritual sense, that I would feel otherwise. I really believe that my ordinations and the sacraments are like seeds that have been implanted into me. And this is how I see it when I talk about sacraments or giving sacraments to other people. I see them as seeds that are being given by the empowerment of the apostolic succession, for example, and because they were conceived in a certain symbolism and in a certain way, they're tools. And every ordination or every sacrament implants a seed in your soul. And these are absolutely powerful potential seeds. And you as the initiate, or you as the person who have undergone these ordinations, now it's your duty to actually bring these seeds to flowering, to prosperity. You need to nurture them properly, and you need to make sure that your person or your soul is prepared as fertile ground for these seeds to take root. It's the same as if you have a seed, and you throw it on a rocky ground, it probably won't take root and it will just rot. But if you throw a seed in a fertile ground, it may grow to a strong tree. And it's the same thing with with Gnostic ordinations. This is why, for example, I do not believe that if you're made a bishop or if you're being made a priest or if you're being made a deacon or something, and just by the grace of the ordination, you have all the powers of the degree or of the office. I do not believe in this at all. I believe it's a combination of forces. It's a combination of forces from outside which are being given, and you need to alchemically fuse this with your own readiness and with your own proper occult work. You need to nurture it. And only then do I believe things take root. This is why I do not believe, for example, that every Gnostic bishop or that every Gnostic priest who's been ordained actually functions properly in his office. I think a lot of people are just shallow, empty shadows, you know. It's, you know, people who buy an ordination, for example, or who barter ordinations, you know, simply, and have never studied any of the Gnosticism. For me, they cannot logically even function as a proper guardian of this esoteric current. How can he?
Very good point.
And so for me, I've worked very hard on every ordination. I've worked extremely hard on what it means, what the different ordinations mean. What means the baptism? What is the charism? What is the function of the diaconate? I have really worked through these offices in an esoteric and exoteric way, with a very thorough focus. And the more I regard it as that, the more I regard it the working on, let's say, the diaconate or something, or the priesthood, as nurturing the seed that I have been given, the more powerful this became, the more powerful the seed took root. And so for me, every stage I went through, and as a bishop, of course, it has provided me with a tremendous experience of spirituality, or of who I am. It has provided me the most important insights into who I am as a person, as a human, but also as an esoteric entity, and my relationship to, let's say, the great all. And my magical work, my work as a mage, is probably the exploration of possibilities. You know, when you see attainment, let's say you see your overall magical or your overall spiritual attainment as ascending a mountain, I would see my magical work, so my Gnostic work would be, you know, the path up the mountain, and my magical work would probably be the exploration of the mountain as such.
Mm.
You know, taking time to check out what's actually there.
Mm-hmm.
So, in my magical work, actually, I'm fulfilling my cravings of explorations. I think if I would have born in the 16th century or 17th century, and if I wouldn't have become, you know, a kind of heretical occultist, I would probably have become a sea captain for the Portuguese or the Spanish, you know, and I would have probably discovered America. You know, I mean, I always had this kind of craving for discovering, especially, of course, my own potentials, my own possibilities. And I saw occultism always as a very interesting tool to explore in detail what is possible for the human being in regards to all types of things, you know, spiritism, even effect magic, although this to me plays no role in my life anymore, you know, materialistic magic or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, all kinds of things, you know, can you influence the world around you in a direct way? All these kinds of questions. But most importantly, magical work provides me with esoteric research, basically, magical research,
mm-hmm.
you know, of what Berthue and Kenneth Grant write about, you know. It provides me spirit contacts, and it provides me with insights into the realm, different dimensions of existence and spirit and occultism, dimensional contacts, all these kinds of things. For me, these are tools, or the use of runes, for example, in the Fraternitas Borealis, you know. They provide me with interesting tools to, venture down in my, let's call it even ancestral psyche, or in my, other areas of my unconsciousness, if you want to, you know, be Jungian and so on and so forth. It, you know, it's for me, it's research. For me, it's simple research and experimentation. Mm-hmm. So this is and for me, of course, the overall more important in a general sense is probably, of course, my Gnostic attainment, because that is basically what provides me with my spiritual liberty and freedom. But my magical work helps me in this, helps me, of course, and supplements my work in there. You know, sometimes, of course, magical work gives me glimpses and clues which very strongly, you know, reflect on my spiritual existence. And not for nothing are all the groups I'm in kind of Gnostic groups. I mean, the OTUA and the LCN, it's not called Voodoo Gnosis for nothing. I mean, even there, the magical work is employed to supplement and to back up also your overall spiritual development. So it's not, I don't know, you know, it's not doing simple sigil magic for, you know, gaining, you know, chicks and money.
All right.
So, does that make any sense?
That makes perfect sense. I think it's important to sort of talk about this. And I think it's it is a facet of many esoteric groups employing, you know, this combination of the ecclesiastic and the magic. And they do serve to... you know, enhance one another greatly, I think.
Absolutely.
As you mentioned.
Absolutely. I think actually I'm very glad you asked that question, because for me this is one of the as you said, it's very important to make this clear, you know, that I mean a lot of people think, you know, it's about collecting these titles and these things, but it's basically about that. It's, you know, you have to ask yourself, why is that? Why is there the ecclesiastic? Why is there, you know, the bishop and the priest and the magician? And, you know, how can you combine these? And a real occultist or a real esotericist, he must do exactly that. You know, he must basically really, you know, investigate these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah, you're absolutely correct, of course.
All right, let's see. Next question I had was, this is obviously much more of a philosophical, but what do you believe that the reason for these teachings, which are, in my opinion, far more esoteric than what was previously available to the general public, mm-hmm. are now available openly, and what does it really say about the times in which we live or about the state of humanity, if anything?
Mm-hmm. I find that question really interesting. I mean, I think actually both things could stand as a question on its own. I mean, but why are these things available? It's hard to say, actually. I don't think there is one reason. I mean, of course, it's because I think people dare, you know, to publish things much more openly, because there is no real fear of persecution anymore if they actually publish something under their name, or, you know, printing presses and stuff like that can publish these things without going broke or without being boycotted and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a simple, you know, there's simply more possibilities, you know, internet and all these kinds of things. Plus, but at the same time, one must ask, how many of these things are actually authentic, you know? I mean, today everybody can publish anything, you know? I mean, in the internet you have the chance to, you know, pretend you just dug out a manuscript from your dad's attic and, you know, it's the greatest magical, you know, finding of the century, and you just make it up and post it. And, how, for the beginner or for a young person, you probably wouldn't be able to distinguish whether that's, you know, that's a fake or not. So I think the quantity is really greatly enhanced, and although, of course, I think the quality or as you said, you know, fundamental esoteric texts are much easier available today. But I think you still have to be very, very careful to distinguish what is what. You know, what is just gibberish? What is just the rehab of every? You know, I don't know. What is the rehapping of the old things, or what is really a new esoteric text of esoteric quality, and what not?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I think one of the reasons why there are these things available is probably because there is a greater need today. You know, I think Stefan Heller, you know, a fellow Gnostic of ours, I think he said, he once said, you know, he believes that, you know, the Nakamadi and so on, these findings, you know, they came to light because the world is probably in a, you know, in a crisis, so that these things just pop up again, you know. And, you know, when the world is in crisis, such things probably appear out of, you know, out of nowhere. And I actually believe that the world is in a huge crisis. I mean, I'm a very big critic of the modern times, I must say. And I'm rather the Evolaian, you could say, you know, in regards to believing that we are spiraling in a kind of a spiritual abyss, you know, and that I just hope that there is the golden cycle coming up very soon. Mm. I believe actually we're deep down in Kali Yuga right now. And to me, there is at the same time a possibility for people to gather and a lot of important information, but the question is, do these people actually make any use of them? If I look at the publications of the last 50 years, or especially the last 30 years, I think the quality of magical writings and of new people, you know, bringing out new materials or actually researching further from what has actually already been researched, is very, very slim. I think if I look around at the younger guard, I mean, you know, discount Kenneth Grant and Michael Burdieu, you know, discard the old guard, but everybody, you know, 50 and younger, I don't think there are a lot of people actually who are standout figures. Mm. And if I look at the occult revival back in the days, I think there were far few, you know, much fewer people involved in occultism, but the quality of people that you had there was a lot higher, for some weird reason. Mm-hmm. And this is my personal observation, or at least you had a lot of interesting figures who actually did their own research, who really fundamentally researched things, and you could see that they are actually deep thinkers, you know. And I think we are in a world where everything has become very McDonald's type, you know?
Yes.
Everybody is looking for the quick fix. And everybody is looking for, you know, easy answers to complex questions. And it's not so much the fault of the people, it's the fault of the society, the way it developed, the way it spiraled. You know, I think superficiality is what glues people together these days. You know, and you can see it. You can see it expressed in literature in general. You know, if you talk to normal publishing companies, they cannot publish anymore any kind of poetry or any kind of philosophy because nobody will buy it. Actually,
right.
You know, there is no more demand for Weltanschauung. You know, there is no more demand for deep thoughts, and people have just lost the ability to really go deep. They're not interested in it. They want to have a wild ride. And occultism has become a part of pop culture. You know? Is interesting as long as it's entertaining, and it's interesting as long as it's kind of like wild. But as soon as it gets kind of like, if you have to actually work, and if you actually have to do boring stuff, you know, people move on. You know, people are just a product of their society, and it doesn't stop from invading occultism as well. So I believe we are in a time which is very crucial. I think, you know, the crises we have, the political and all the crises we have in the world, are also a reflection of a spiritual crisis as well. You know, I mean, the whole crisis we have right now, economical crisis and stuff like that, People maybe now will start to realize that, you know, the god Mammon that has filled their void, you know, after, let's say, the Enlightenment period, is not actually doing his job in a way that really satisfies them properly. Mm-hmm. You know, now when consumerism is not actually happening as it did in the past, maybe people come back to a more introspective or a more reflective type of life. And, well, you know, I just encourage everybody to read, René Guénon and Evola, or especially also Ludwig Klages. And although you don't have to take this radical stance on, you know, the crisis of the modern world, I do believe it actually gives a very good picture of where we are spiraling to, you know, and what every individual can do to retain a kind of, let's call it spiritual dignity or spiritual ideals that actually does take him further. That where you can retain, even if the world, you know, around you spirals more and more into profanity, that you can still actually make use of the mass and the wealth of esoteric information, like you correctly said, which is out there. But you just have to have the will to actually study it and find it and actually do the work. And this is what most people don't do. They have all the chances, but they really don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the reason why they don't do it is a reflection of the society we live in. People just don't have the capacity. They just don't like it. They just don't want it. They just don't really feel like sitting down and studying properly. This is not what they have been told. You know?
Yes.
And it's reflected when I speak to other people, to other, you know, let's say leading initiates of occult groups. It's amazing. You know, people apply for membership, and they apply to you as customers, you know. It's funny. People approach, you know, occult groups and say, well, you know, I'm interested in your groups. Give me information. And, well, you know, you give them information, and, you know, of course they don't, you know, you have to kind of like ask them to give you, you know, to give information back about themselves. Well, okay, then they do. And in the end, you know, they come to you in a way that say like, okay, I like what I read, so I want to become a member. And when they become a member, they, like consumers, expect you to provide something for them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They said like, okay, now I became a member, and now I want you to provide me with illumination. Give me the cool stuff. Give me the cool sounding things I was actually hoping to get while I was reading your webpage or your cool books, you know? And they have a specific idea of what they want. And they have a specific attitude, and they actually expect you, because they graced you with their membership, to actually provide that. And if you don't, they threaten you with moving to another group. Not that they say that, but, you know, they say, well, you know, there are so many other groups out there, you know, if you don't provide, I'll go to another one. They'll be happy to have me, you know. And this is the kind of consumerist attitude the Western person actually displays. While 150 years ago, you know, like even if I read Crowley's, you know, Crowley's diaries and Crowley's confessions and so on, even he, you know, he was hardcore searching for occult groups to actually, you know, to attach himself to, and when he found them, he was, you know, he was more or less at awe to finally have found, you know, the secret, the hidden church of the elect and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you still see in Sufism or other groups, you know, where the people who go to such groups are really kind of like, you know, have the right attitude. It's not that they want something, but they give everything that they have to the path, and they do what is necessary. And, you know, they don't have this this weird consumerist attitude.
That's right.
You know, but we have been taught this. We have been taught this in school and in society, you know, that we're individuals, you know. We have, of course, also a problem with authority. You know, don't take any authority over you, you know. You're your own person. You know, you take what you want. This is a free world. You know, there's a lot of selection. Select what you like. And this is the attitude we bring into everything. And I think it's counterproductive in occultism and in spirituality, absolutely.
I could not agree anymore. And I think it also, you know, you mentioned this earlier, too, and it's a whole idea that seems to maybe have been forgotten for some time. Hopefully it'll return. But that you people are engaging in these in this work to know in order to serve, not to know to, you know, aggrandize themselves or,
exactly,
you know, enrich themselves, but to serve a higher purpose.
Exactly. And this to me is the main point, you know, is the main point. That actually, and the funny thing is, and in the end, what you serve, the higher purpose you serve is ultimately you.
Right.
Because you should feel the vocation. You should feel the vocation to transform. And so the higher purpose you serve is basically yourself, because, you know, you reflect that higher purpose. And this is what people don't understand. They what they usually want is to, as I said, aggrandize themselves, you know, and fulfill more or less profane cravings, egocentrical cravings. I'm not against, you know, demolishing the ego. I think the ego is actually very needed to actually, you know, have a direction, to actually, you know, have a motivation to take a step forward. But if the ego is in control, if the ego is not under the rule of, let's say, the overall purpose, the higher purpose that you mentioned, then, you know, everything is misdirected.
Absolutely. All right, so the last question here is, and, you know, feel free to sort of expound upon your thoughts, but any hopes or plans for the future of this work, aside from, you know, the personal evolution of those involved, that you'd care to share with us?
You mean on a global basis, or could you be more precise?
I think in terms of like the OTO, LCN, yeah. Ecclesia, Gnostica Aeterna, Fraternitas Borealis, and sort of your hopes for these groups and as they do their work and presence themselves.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. Well, like, my hope for these groups is basically to remain as integer as they are. I want my hopes for these groups is that they remain a rather selective, small group of initiates who really do the job to actually educate and bring forth people who can take their true place in the chain of masters, you can say. Or if it's not these kinds of people, or if we could see chain of masters as not people who teach necessarily, but who actually attain to a certain transformative state. I want these groups to, even in this world where everything becomes corporated, where everything becomes a mass product, where everything becomes a power structure, where most occult groups or most spiritual groups, if they have the chance, you know, to sell out, let's say, they'll do it, you know, because in the end, it's power they crave. You know, you can see it with a lot of occult groups who started as small occult circles, you know, who really did secret occult magic and all of these kinds of things. And now there are big, big organizations, and I'm not only referring to, let's say, the Caliphate or anything like that, Rosicrucians, a lot of these groups. That these groups transform from magical entities to, let's say, more politically orientated entities. Mm-hmm. And I hope that our groups, or the groups that I'm involved in, and the reason why I'm involved in is precisely that. If I would see that they would change, I probably wouldn't be involved in them, you know. I want them to retain their magical and occult status. I want them to continue to be guardians and protectors of important esoteric transmissions and empowerments, and not for these things to get lost. You need to really have a strict, selective agenda. And this is really what I hope will happen in the future, because I believe that these are groups or that such types of groups will be at the forefront of, let's call it this, this spiritual war that is raging in the Kali Yuga, you know. Mm-hmm. I believe that these places are little small pockets of resistance, you know, against a kind of monoculture, a kind of spiritual monoculture, a spiritual degeneration, where everything becomes simplified, where everything becomes simplistic, where everything is just about having a good time. And I think these groups provide still an ancient type of integrity, where students are being guided and mentored by teachers, where people try at least to have a certain attitude towards the great work, and which then in their own place, you know, give this kind of knowledge and give this kind of experience to younger students. And I believe this could lead to a domino effect. And I think in this in these times in which we live, I don't think like New Age people believe that there is, you know, we're going to ascend to the whatever dimension, you know, anytime soon as a collective. Actually, I believe it's the contrary. I believe that things are spiraling in a very, very in very weird times. And I think if such groups as ours maintain their function, we will be able to continue to produce a chain of initiates that will last until these dark times are over. And when these times are over, these people then will probably, you know, help like a small domino effect to kick a new kind of consciousness into action. I hope really that at one point, in whenever that may be, that there will be a change in mentality, that this extreme, exploitative, dualist attitude that rules this world, which is a product of not only of Christianity, but of any kind of dualist religion or system, capitalism, or any, these are all product of a dualism where the earth and where human life is regarded as absolutely unimportant in favor of some kind of theoretical afterlife or Armageddon, you know, the world will be transformed when the Messiah comes back and so forth and so forth. And this kind of attitude, which is predominant in the secular world as well, of course, in capitalism, these attitudes must be overcome at one point, I hope. And as long as our groups can maintain integrity to what they do, I think they are providing a much-needed safe haven for the very, very, very few people that understand that concept. You know, I don't think it's mass compatible at all, and I really don't want it to be either. So, and I hope it may influence, even through writings, you know. I mean, I'm one of the few people who reads the obscure guy Ludwig Klages. But, you know, for me, you know, these types of people, they, even if it's only inspiring, I don't know, 10 people in a generation who then, I don't know, you know, produce something that inspires others, I think as long as such a link is provided, you know, this is what I hope is going to happen. And then let's see, you know, I hope there will be a time in the world where humanity on a much larger level, you know, will attain to, I don't know, you know, cosmic consciousness or something, you know, as a collective. I hope that. That's my utopian hope, you know, for the very far future.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah. 100%. So, Tal David Beth, author of Voodoo Gnosis, available from Scarlet Imprint. I will put up links to the book as well as your websites, Cosmic Gnosis, OTOA, LCN, so people can find you online. I really want to thank you very much for all of the wisdom that you've imparted to us today, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here. I mean, it was your questions that I actually found extremely interesting, and I really do hope that people will get something out of it. And I hope it made some sense what we talked about today. So, anytime again. I really enjoyed this.